I'm going to go ahead and read the thing. In the year 1080, Pope Gregory VII wrote to Harald III of Denmark, telling him in no uncertain terms that killing innocent women because they were suspected of being witches and causing storms or crops to fail was, in the religious sense, what we call a big no-no. In accordance with religious law of Gregory VII's time, witches or sorceresses were capable of magic, just like anyone else who studied magic, but they were not necessarily in league with the devil, demons, or dark spirits. The recommended remedy was confession, repentance, and charity. Over time, the attitude towards witches, sorcerers, and magic changed, at first as a form of idolatry and sinning through the worship of those other than God, then becoming framed in the terms of being explicitly in league with the devil. And while magics used to be an equal opportunity sin, available to everyone equally, it became associated more and more frequently with only women. And in the gross turn that everybody could see coming, especially women who refused to sleep with the Inquisitor accusing them. So we come from having women who knew which herbs could help out a sick tummy to being burned at the stake, drowned with a dunking stool, and the repression of an entire half of humanity based on no requirements other than not being a dude. So how did we get there? Well, a guy wrote a book, and we're still feeling the aftershocks of it today. On this episode of Relative Disasters, the Malleus Maleficarum. Welcome to Relative Disasters, the show where I blend Eye of Newt with Wart of Toad, put that into a scented candle, and then shape that candle into a podcast that I light for my sister and anyone else who feels like listening. My much cooler big sister and I manage our existential dread by talking with each other about terrible and interesting historical events, their context, implications, and any related sidebars that tend to be distracting. My name is Greg, my sister's name is Ella, and Ella, today we're going to talk about how one massive misogynist shaped gender roles and relations for hundreds of years. Our sources for this episode include the Malleus Maleficarum by Heinrich Kramer, issued in 1487, Canon Episcopi, issued around 906, the papal bull Summus Desiderantis Affectibus, issued in 1484, and a number of biblical scholarship articles as well as contextual analyses by modern scholars. Okay, let's just get this out of the way. We're going to be discussing the Christian Bible and the Catholic Church organization in a historical context, not as matters of faith. If you're somebody for whom such a discussion would be uncomfortable, please feel free to skip this episode. The early organized Christian church did not really give a tinker's cuss about witches. The idea of people having access to magic predates Christianity by at least 2,000 years, as Hammurabi of Babylon had a law about it. If a man is accused of witchcraft, he must be plunged into the holy river. If he's killed by the river, his accuser may take the man's house. I'm not sure what the real estate market was like in ancient Babylon, but if all you needed to do was point at a guy to get a free house, that particular law may have been abused. The early Bible has multiple mentions in Aramaic, Greek, and Hebrew, words translated as witch. Saul claims to have met one, and Leviticus calls for the stoning of anyone using divination. In the New Testament, there are multiple prohibitions on the practices of magic, and magic was an accepted fact of reality back in the day. State punishments of burnings at the stake predate the church ones by a few hundred years, though only as an imposed death penalty for causing someone else's death through curse or enchantment. At the Synod of Elvira in the early 300s, the council established that the casting of spells was a form of idolatry. The penalty for this was to be refused the Eucharist. Also in that council, by the way, were penalties for people who beat their slaves to death, 7 years of penance if intentional, 5 years if they beat the person to death accidentally, official orders to smash the false idols of your slaves, or at least avoid them to remain pure, and that baptized women were not allowed to associate with hairdressers or men with long hair. Women were also not allowed to write to other people without their husband's consent, and were not allowed to receive letters unless they were also addressed to her husband. Also, chariot racers and stage performers were not allowed to be baptized, so sorry, fellas. And the images of worship should not be painted on walls, so I guess that changed by the time of Michelangelo. What I'm saying is there are a lot of things on their plate at the time. And let's be honest here, women have never enjoyed much standing in the church, from the Book of St. Perpetua being edited and censored or outright removed, to the large number of Gospels considered as apocrypha and non-canonical that focus on early Christian women, or the possibility of Mary of Magdalene being another apostle. Lots of women-centric stuff ended up on the cutting room floor in the final edit of the textual Bible, and while they all make for fascinating reading, what fragments we have left, they serve to eliminate the counter-arguments to the male-dominated church. Much of that control comes from the tradition, with the capital T, argument that only men may be priests because Jesus only chose men as his apostles. Since having a woman as an apostle would significantly undercut that argument, it's not a huge surprise that those books were excised. At any rate, the pursuit of witches was encouraged with restraint. The Council of Paderborn specifically calls for the faithful to be mindful of their own fanaticism and to convert pagans, not use them as kindling. Pope Nicholas I in 866 forbade the use of torture to elicit confessions, and the traditional test of discovering witchcraft by dunking, which was the practice of submerging a woman in cold water, was in good standing. If the woman sank below the surface, she was acquitted and helped out of the water. The church as a whole was more concerned with converting so-called pagans to Christianity, admittedly by the sword if necessary, but it's kind of a step in the right direction for people following the Prince of Peace. Burchard, Bishop of Worms in 1020, wrote a whole treatise on witchcraft, allowing for the existence of magical potions that could, for example, induce sleep, induce ardor, or induce abortion, all of which can be done with the correct chemicals in the proper proportions, but that so-called witches did not have access to real magical powers that they have been credited with, such as flying or causing storms or transforming people into animals, etc. Shortly afterwards is when Pope Gregory VII told King Harald III to cease his persecutions of women based on nothing more than suspicions and bad weather. There is a bit of a sea change just around the corner, however. The papal Inquisition began to prosecute witchcraft, spurred by Pope Alexander IV's directive that the Inquisition should focus on heresy, and what was more heretical than magical powers. In Toulouse in 1275, a woman was burned at the stake after being tortured into confessing that she had sex with a demon, given birth to a demon baby, and fed it human babies. This sparked a whole new panic around witches that even suckered in St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Bonaventure, two otherwise very cool guys. Despite this new rise in persecution, most church investigations took a more common-sense approach, treating tales of women flying around and engaging in nocturnal frolics with demons with suspicion and skepticism and often rejection of the charges. All of this was building to something, however. It only needed an authority figure who wanted to expand his authority and a terrible person who really wanted to punish women for not sleeping with him. And we got both. Heinrich Kramer was born around 1430 in Germany. He joined the Dominican order as soon as he was eligible and quickly rose to the position of prior. Around 1470, he was appointed inquisitor to the regions of Tyrol, Salzburg, Moravia, and Bohemia in Germany. He was tireless, constantly traveling and giving multiple sermons a day, rising quickly to become the right-hand man of the Archbishop of Salzburg through sheer dedication. His career was going quite well, preaching against sin and offering his inquisitor's zeal to whoever needed it. However, said zeal was starting to rub people the wrong way, given his pattern of marching into town, declaring a woman, usually an attractive woman, a sinner and a witch, and attempting a trial. After a few of those resulted in multiple embarrassments for the church, local ecclesiastical authorities stopped humoring him, and the Archbishop of Salzburg quietly withdrew his support. Rather than re-examining his life choices, Kramer decided to go speak to the manager. In his case, of course, the manager was the Pope, and the Pope at the time had been looking for an excuse to solidify his grip on power within the Catholic Church, so he did exactly that. At the time, especially in Germany, there was jurisdiction friction between the local church leaders, who answered to their local communities, and the Inquisition, which answered directly to the Pope. Pope Innocent VIII had been frustrated by the German church caring more about their people than about what he wanted, so he decided to remind them who ran the whole show. He issued a papal bull, a decree by the Pope, that recognized the existence of witches and declared that only the Inquisition was properly equipped to root them out. At Kramer's urging, Pope Innocent stated that there was a huge outbreak of witchcraft in Germany, specifically in the area that Kramer was assigned to operate in, funny enough, and stated that the local church authorities who did not assist and cooperate with the officers of the Inquisition could be excommunicated. Kramer took that papal bull and went to the village of Innsbruck to root out evil. What he found was a woman who captivated him and who was utterly repulsed by him. Helena Schuberin had her first run-in with Heinrich Kramer shortly after his arrival. Apparently he walked past her on the street, and she turned her head from him, stating loudly enough to be heard that he was, and I'm paraphrasing here, an overzealous jackass, and he turned that into a charge of her spitting on him and issuing a curse to him. Days later, he confronted her about not attending his sermons, and she responded with, again, paraphrasing, that he was obsessed with witches, not the teachings of Jesus, and she would not be attending his sermons until they became a little more Christian. All of this, rolled together, obviously resulted in the charge of witchcraft. Something else had happened behind the scenes. Helena Schuberin was married, quite happily it seems, and Heinrich had behaved lustfully towards her, publicly noted as such by one of the other Inquisition officers and by her husband. He would stare at her as she passed on the street. He would call on her at inappropriate times, often trying to catch her without her husband present, and he wrote a piece about how his lust for her was all her fault. For her part, she tried to avoid him as much as possible until he brought her to trial. Helena and her husband Sebastian appealed to the Bishop of Brixen, Georg Gosser. Gosser reviewed the papal bill and stated that Kramer was well within his rights to conduct a trial, at which Gosser, as the bishop, would be presiding as judge. The trial was a disaster. Kramer brought up his charges, one after the other, and they failed to impress the court. Helena had failed to appear at Kramer's sermons. She was not required to attend. She cursed him in the street. Okay, the lady is reminded to be gentle in her language. She causes lust in me, a man of God. And Golson's official opinion was basically, that sounds like a you problem, man. With his charges failing to gain traction, Kramer began a series of wild accusations with regards to Helena's sexuality, sexual proclivity, trysts, sexual everything, causing Gosser to suspend the trial midday and mid-testimony in an attempt to get him to chill out. Gosser issued a scathing rebuke of Kramer's behavior, and when Kramer cited the papal bull, Gosser reminded him that he was there to investigate heresy, not one woman's sexuality. Gosser urged him to end the trial since he had no basis for it. When Kramer refused, Gosser ordered him to leave his diocese. Schuberin, her husband, and the six other women Kramer had gone after were all released with the profoundest apologies of the church. Kramer retreated to Cologne, his pride injured, and looking for revenge. He started writing. What would emerge from his pen was a treatise on how every action a woman took was in order to tempt men away from righteousness and was in service of the devil, and to just generally lay the foundation for the incel movement a few hundred years ahead of schedule. Malleus Maleficarum, directly translated as Hammer of Witches, but more appropriately translated as Hammer for Witches, is quite the piece of literature. We're going to go through its main body, section by section. In the first section, Kramer tackles the question of, do witches exist? Now, keeping in mind the general thinking of the day, this is an attempt to lay to rest the question of whether there are women with magical powers, or whether there are people who are simply deluded into thinking that they have magical powers. Kramer's logic goes as follows. The devil is real, therefore witches are real, therefore witches are in league with the devil and have entered a pact with him, usually a sexual one, in return for harmful powers. Section 2 establishes that women are essentially evil, using their bodies as instruments of temptation to harm men's souls, and using witchcraft to tempt the few righteous women into joining their sisterhood of devil skanks, which, let's be honest here, that is a great band name. Upstanding women in their communities will have witches cause problems in their lives until they go to those witches for help, and are thus seduced, and young women will have incubi sent to them in the night to tempt them to the devil. It also details how women cast spells, and some things that people can do to protect themselves or assist those who have been attacked by witches. Section 3 is a practical guide to the prosecution of witches, from how to assemble the accusers, to how to properly torture witnesses and the accused, to charging and the appropriate punishment for the established witch. If a woman did not cry during her trial, by the way, that meant that she was a witch. If a woman wailed and carried on in a manner upsetting to the men in an obvious effort to gain sympathy, of course, she was also a witch. One can only wonder what the method for the measurement of an appropriate amount of tears for innocence would be. Now, this entire book is filled not only with these horrific attacks on women, but also with these, like, extremely petty little shots taken at the people who stopped Kramer in his quest for hounding these women. He reprints the entire papal bull at the beginning of this book, basically stating that everything in this book is approved by the Pope. He adds in a forged approval from the theological faculty of the University of Cologne, who had already told him to pound sand when he came to them, and then a ranting preamble that threatens all of the priests who refuse to go along with his one-man war on every woman he encountered. It's a trip, is what I'm saying. Also, to add to the fake claims of the book, about 30 years after the book was issued, and about 25 years after the man in question had died, Kramer slapped on the name of another famous inquisitor, Jakob Sprenger, as co-author. Now, it is noted in Sprenger's own writings that he disagreed with Kramer on just about everything, and again, this co-authorship was added 25 years after the man had died. Kramer's recommendation of torture seems like it's meant to seem like a fair and measured response. At one point, he reminds inquisitors to not just torture people, but also give them a break from torture while you merely threaten them with more torture. Also, as long as you're not repeating a method of torture, it doesn't violate the church's laws against excessive torture. Also, it was fine to lie to your subject in any way you wanted because they're in league with the devil anyway, so telling them that you'll have their whole family killed if they don't confess is fine because you're just telling them that. You're not really going to do it. Well, unless they're witches too. He establishes that witches are nearly universally women because women are spiritually weaker and more easily given to corruption than men. If you're seeing some parallels with modern misogyny, I don't know what to tell you, my dudes. History has like three themes. Scholars of this book point out that the majority of the people accused of witchcraft, both by Kramer and by those under Kramer's guidance, were women who spoke their minds and stood up for themselves, so obviously witches. I'm going to share with you some choice quotes here. According to Kramer, women are, quote, prone to believing demons sent to corrupt their faith, end quote, since they are not, quote, naturally pure like men, and are, of course, slaves to lust and vice, end quote. He reasons that the foundation of witchcraft is denial of the true faith and, quote, "Woman, therefore, is evil as a result of nature because she doubts more quickly in the faith," end quote. This even extends, interestingly enough, to the title. Malleus Maleficarum is in feminine Latin. If he had intended it in its masculine form, it would have been Maleficorum, since the male form of the noun is considered the universally gendered one, i.e. the one you would use as a default. This is another clear attack on the objects of his really gross attentions. Multiple arguments in favor of legal and religious discrimination against women are made, which are not anything new. Just to be clear here, it's not like he made all this stuff up. What he did was tied together long-standing religious and social misogyny into one comprehensive text. As the scholar Sigrid Brauner wrote, quote, "In his world, everything exists in pairs of opposites, God and Satan, good and evil, men and women. Each positive principle in a pair is delineated by its negative. Perfection is defined not as the integration or preservation of opposites, but rather as the extermination of the negative element in a polar pair. Because women are the negative counterpart to men, they corrupt male perfection through witchcraft and must be destroyed." End quote. As a work of self-justification and revenge, the book serves its purpose. Kramer gets to be a gigantic, raging waste of flesh and organs. The people involved get upset. Everybody gets to lose. Except that the book took off like wildfire. Almost overnight, buoyed by that papal bill, Kramer became the chief celebrity of the Inquisition, testifying about witches to the Nuremberg Council, giving lectures in Venice, getting appointed papal nuncio, and made the provincial superior to the whole of Germany in 1488. Between 1487 and 1520, 20 editions of the Malleus Maleficarum were published, spreading quickly throughout Europe and adding more fuel to the fire of these witch hunts. With the Reformation and Counter-Reformation factions vying for the future of Christianity between the Protestants and the Catholics, the book allowed both sides to use it as a weapon against the other, accusing each other of lack of purity of their faith and demonstrating that by attacking their women. Look, some of the stuff in this book is objectively funny. Apparently, according to Kramer, witches have a spell specifically simply to remove a man's penis. The book is so over the top in its accusations and justifications that it reads like a self-parody, like something that somebody attempting to discredit the very idea of persecuting women based on evidence like they sneezed. But just like all of these movements, the people with a vested interest in suppressing women took it seriously. It, and the tactics of it, and the mindset of it, have influenced religions, governments, laws, and public opinion. The book itself, nowadays, may be mostly forgotten, but the damage it did to people's ability to see each other as people, not as objects of hate and lust, is still felt today. And of course, its overriding themes of blaming women for the feelings men have towards them are only getting stronger in this age of wonderful internet connectivity. Here's what I take away from the whole thing. This guy was a loon, and we would have been better off if he'd just found another vocation. Maybe writing bad poetry. And that's it. That's the story behind the Malleus Maleficarum and the horrifying ripple effects on it, the relationships between human beings. Here at Relative Disasters, we make sure to fact-check our work to bring you the most accurate disasters possible. If you would like to know more about our sources, they are cited at the beginning of the episode. Sometimes we do make mistakes, of course, so if you have any thoughts you'd like to share or corrections we need to know, please write to us at relative.disasters@gmail.com. We cannot respond to emails, but we do read each one, we promise. I want to thank Jeffrey for writing in with his feedback. Jeffrey has kind of spoken for the group here. A lot of folks miss Ella, and particularly miss sort of the give and take of conversation as opposed to what's turned into kind of an unfortunate lecture series, which is not my intent. I am trying to get other people to come on, but the recording process is sort of weird, and I'm hoping to line up a few more folks to have actual genuine conversations with, but keeping up with the once a week schedule is hard for me to have to impose that on other people. So I'm trying, and I will certainly try to do better. And thank you all. Thank you, Jeffrey. And thank you, everybody else who had written in with basically that same feedback. And of course, if you'd like to shame us publicly, and we know you do, why not try our Instagram at relative.disasters. A humongous thank you to our patrons who support us at Relative Disasters Podcast on Patreon. You guys are great and help us justify keeping this podcast ad-free. If anybody else out there wants to join the Patreon, $5 gets you access to all of the extra Patreon content, including now 2 Patreon-specific episodes a month, and $10 gets you our eternal thanks. You're awesome. We'd like to thank our major disasters, as always, Katie and Georgia, for their support. You guys are fantastic. And this week's episode was brought to you by Paul, who would like to remind the Heinrich Kramers of the world that attacking half the world's population for not dating you is not a great way to meet new and fun people. And Allie Z, who needs a refund on her broomstick, which simply won't go over 5 miles an hour. Thank you all so much for joining us for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed the story, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Ella, next week we're going down into the coal mines again, heading up to beautiful British Columbia and into one of the most horrific mining disasters ever. This isn't a cave-in or a collapse. No, it's an explosion. On the next episode of Relative Disasters, the 1887 Nanaimo Mine Explosion. Have a good week, and I'll see you then.